A well-regulated militia be necessary to the security of a free state. Right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad to be with you once again behind the microphone for another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. You can find me on Twitter at Cam Edwards. But I haven't been on Twitter much the last few days. Life's been getting in the way, but hopefully I'll return here shortly. On the program today, we've got an armed citizen story for you out of Reno, Nevada. We've got a recidivist report from Alabama that is just absolutely tragic. We've got also got a pretty beefy interview with Larry Keen, who is with the National Shooting Sports Foundation, general counsel with the Firearms Industry Trade Group. You know, yesterday we saw the Supreme Court decide not to hear an appeal by Remington in a lawsuit that's been brought by parents whose children were murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary in Newtown, Connecticut. And Remington had argued that this case was prevented by from moving forward by the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. The Connecticut State Supreme Court had disagreed with Remington's assertion, saying that there was basically one claim that could be brought forward in court, even with the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, and it relates to advertising and marketing practices. And so this case is now going to proceed. I wanted to talk with Larry because I've heard from a lot of folks asking, okay, well, what does this mean for the industry? What does this mean for other litigation? What does this mean for the case that the Supreme Court's going to be hearing next month in oral arguments, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City? Should we, you know, be reading anything into this? So sat down with Larry Keen. He answered all of those questions and more. Take a look and a listen. Well, Larry, thank you so much, sir, for coming on the program today. It's good talking with you.
It was a pleasure to spend time with you, Cam.
You know, and I know baseball season's over. We can talk about our sad seasons at some future point here. But let's talk about the Supreme Court and the decision yesterday not to grant this appeal in the case Remington versus Soto, allowing this case to proceed in Connecticut. What is the industry's reaction to the Supreme Court not hearing Remington's appeal?
Well, obviously, we're disappointed that the court didn't accept the cert petition to review what we consider to be the erroneous decision by the Connecticut Supreme Court interpreting the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act. We recognize, though, that it's very difficult to ever get the Supreme Court to take a case. They only grant very few cert petitions out of the, you know, 7,000+ that we see every year. There may be only 100 or so. And the posture that the case came to the Supreme Court made it even less likely because it's not a final judgment.
Mm-hmm.
So normally you can't appeal until you have a final judgment, you know, the end of the proceeding in state court. There's an exception for that called the collateral order doctrine. We thought that this case fit into that doctrine because it's a preemption statute. You're not supposed to have to defend a case at all. And we think that the lawsuit is exactly the type of case that the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act was designed to stop. It is, at bottom, an attempt to blame the manufacturer of a legal, non-defective product that was lawfully sold many years before the incident for the subsequent criminal misuse of that product by someone else, in this case, Adam Lanza, who stole it from his mother. The plaintiffs concocted a, you know, creative legal theory to try to circumvent the statute. Unfortunately, the Connecticut Supreme Court agreed with them, again, by one vote, 4-3, very narrow victory for the plaintiffs. So the case now goes back to state court, where the plaintiffs actually have to now prove their allegations. And all that is left is this single claim that somehow advertising by Remington that they cannot show the plaintiffs saw or in any way influenced by is somehow a violation of the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. And as even the Supreme Court in Connecticut said in their decision, it's a Herculean proof problem that the plaintiffs have, and we do not believe that they will be able to show or prove back in support of their allegation, because again, there's no evidence that Mrs. Lanza saw any advertising and was therefore encouraged to buy the firearm, or more importantly, that Adam Lanza saw any advertising that caused him to then steal the firearm from his mother and commit the heinous act. And I think that we can all agree that if there was any such advertising, the plaintiffs would have plastered that all over the mainstream media. And they haven't, because people believe it doesn't exist. And even the advertising that the plaintiffs tried to point to in the case is advertising that was in certain publications for the, some of it for the military. And again, there's nothing in the advertising that encourages or connotes that someone should criminally misuse the firearm.
Mm-hmm.
It speaks to why the product is reliable, why it is durable, why it has attributes in terms of reliability that will make it appealing to a consumer to use for self-defense and for other lawful purposes, target shooting being the main purpose or reason why people buy these firearms. So it's unfortunate that the Supreme Court didn't take the case. We thought with the new makeup of the court that there was a better chance. But again, the court takes very, very few cases. They've already taken one Second Amendment case, the New York City case, which will be argued. The oral argument in that case is, I believe, slated for the first week of December.
December 2nd, so we'll
yep. Yep. So we'll see how that goes, how that argument goes. So, what's challenging is that if Remington prevails on summary judgment or at trial, and I think they probably prevail on summary judgment, it's very difficult to see how the case gets back to the Connecticut Supreme Court, let alone to the U.S. Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
to have this what we consider the incorrect interpretation of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act.
Well, and so to that end, how wide ranging do you think the impacts of this could be? As you say, and this is ultimately dealing with a suit in state court. The Connecticut State Supreme Court has allowed basically one argument to remain standing here. Do you think that the Supreme Court failing to take up this case, does this open the door for other litigation, similar litigation against other manufacturers, either in Connecticut or in other states?
Well, we've already started to see it, and the plaintiffs led by gun control groups, like every town which has any litigation in it and is involved in suing the industry now, as well as the Brady Center, which has been actively involved in suing members of the industry, have already started to insert this argument into their complaints. We see it in the lawsuit in Las Vegas. We saw it in the lawsuit against rifle manufacturers in federal court in Ohio that was recently dismissed. So we're already starting to see the plaintiffs try to make these sorts of assertions. Many states have statutes, consumer product statutes, similar to the Connecticut Unfair Trade Practices Act. Most don't, however, allow people that are not involved in a commercial contractual relationship to use those statutes for general tort law claims. They tend, and that had been the case in Connecticut until this decision, or to allow them to serve as the basis for a wrongful death action, which is what's going on in the Connecticut case.
Mm-hmm.
They are really about commercial transactions, commercial disputes between a consumer and a business. that's what they exist for. And they're very vague and subject to really being interpreted based on the bias. Honestly, at the end of the day, we think that there's an old adage from Oliver Wendell Holmes that hard cases make bad law. And we think that's really what happened in the Connecticut Supreme Court case, is that everyone feels tremendous sympathy for the victim of this horrific act. But it's wrong to turn around and blame the company that sold a legal product, that was subsequently criminally misused. That's exactly what the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act is designed to prevent. You know, we said in our statement yesterday, while we feel sympathy for the victim family, at the end of the day, Adam Lanza alone is responsible for his criminal misuse of that product, not the manufacturer. And that's really what the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act is about, is the codification of bedrock tort law principles in the United States. That you are responsible for your own actions, and and that's why it says that, it's designed to stop misplacing the blame, and it's the blame and the responsibility rests with the criminal, and they're the sole cause of the harm, not the manufacturer. It's like driving, it's like saying General Motors sells a car, that it's used by somebody to run people down, and they try to claim that, well, he saw advertising on TV showing the car, driving fast around a curve in the mountains. And you see those ads, right? I mean, no one would say that a person who uses a vehicle as a weapon and mows people down into General Motors. That's ridiculous. So, unfortunately, that's where we find ourselves. We are concerned that plaintiffs will try to morph their claims and cleverly draft their complaints to try to find a way to wiggle through the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act.
Where is this? So you say this case now goes back down to state court in Connecticut. Where are we in that trial process? How far along is this case in Connecticut?
Well, unfortunately, even when it was at the trial court level in Connecticut, the court did not dismiss the case outright. The judge allowed discovery to take place for some period of time and then ultimately dismissed the case. And that's what was appealed and went to the Connecticut Supreme Court. So there has been a fair bit of discovery already. It will return for additional discovery. And then after discovery, there will be summary judgment motions, and then if the court denies the summary judgment motions, the case will go to trial for a jury in Connecticut. But I suspect, again, the plaintiffs will not be able to prove their claim. Mm-hmm. They can't prove that anybody saw anything, let alone that it was somehow caused anyone to do anything.
Back in the late 1990s, we saw this campaign by gun control groups to work with cities around the country to try to, sue manufacturers, death by a thousand cuts, bankrupt them with legal fees and that. And that led to the adoption of the Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act in 2005, as well as many of those state level laws that you mentioned earlier. Is this, or are you concerned that that this now opens the door for a new era of anti-gun litigation, or has that already been continued to take place, and this is just another headline that's part of a much bigger story?
We have noticed an increase in litigation against members of the industry, almost always involving these gun control groups. Every town to the Bloomberg funded and the Brady Center. And so we're seeing a continuation or an increase in these lawsuits. They are desperate to try to find a way around Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, which, as you mentioned, was enacted in 2005 in response to the tidal wave of municipal lawsuits, but also other lawsuits, private lawsuits, not involving municipalities, like the Hamilton case, where a number of victims of criminal shootings and their families sued manufacturers in federal court in Brooklyn, New York, before a very activist, liberal activist, Judge Jack Weinstein. And there were other lawsuits where various claims were asserted, public nuisance, ultra-hazardous product. I mean, there aren't long enough to see these things sort of come full circle. There was a wave of litigation in the 70s with various theories, and then a new witness of basically product liability judgment. Then there was a wave of lawsuits in the 80s. Then there was a wave of lawsuits in the 90s. Now we're seeing, and I think we will start to see a wave of lawsuits trying to claim that somehow the advertising is what, you know, caused the problem and caused people to misuse the product. I think that's a stretch, and I don't think juries will buy into that, and hopefully the courts will dismiss those cases as they should.
All right. One last question for you. You noted that the Supreme Court, you know, is asked to hear thousands of cases, and they only select a handful each and every session. I've had a lot of gun owners ask me, okay, what does this mean for the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus New York City case? Should we read anything into this, that the court allowed the suit against Remington to proceed? We've got this gun case coming up. And, you know, understandably, gun owners are a little concerned, I think, and nervous about what the court might do with the New York City case. Can we read anything into this, or is this an entirely separate issue and you really can't find any tea leaves?
I don't think there are any tea leaves you can read here.
Okay.
I think the percentage chance of the Supreme Court taking any cert petition, no matter how meritorious, is low, very low. I mean, they take 100 or something cases out of 7,000, so you do the math. And when it is a collateral order petition, where you don't have a final judgment after a summary judgment motions or a jury trial, your chances are even lower. So there are sort of things the court looks for in deciding whether to accept the petition or not. Is there a conflict in the circuit, in the circuits, for example? And there's a cert petition pending now before the Supreme Court, the Warren case out of the First Circuit, which is a Second Amendment challenge to Massachusetts state statute that bans possession of modern sporting rifles. And so that petition is before the court, and we think it is very clearly it's put in the circuit. And so we'll have to see what the court does in the New York City case, whether it articulates what the standard is, what the standard of review is for Second Amendment challenges. What we have said in our amicus brief in the Warman case is that the appellate courts are not faithfully applying the teachings from Heller and McDonald. They are engaging in an interest-bearing analysis that was specifically rejected by the Supreme Court in Heller, that was proposed by the dissent led by Justice Breyer, where, you know, you look at the infringement, but you look at the countervailing public policy, public safety, and of course, invariably, or nearly invariably, the government wins. And they acknowledge it's an infringement upon the right, but, you know, it's not so bad, and, you know, because you have things like there are other guns available to you, so it's okay to ban these, this class of guns. That is not what Heller said. Heller says that if they are commonly owned for lawful purposes, like modern sporting rifles, then the Second Amendment takes the choice away from the government. It's not for the government to decide for what firearms you're allowed to have. The language of the Second Amendment is pretty clear and straightforward. The right shall not be infringed. It doesn't say infringed but or infringed when. We'll see what happens with the Warman petition. That is certainly take a little while for the court to decide that. I'm not sure exactly when. And we'll see what the court does with the New York City case. It is possible that the Supreme Court in the New York City case can say, we're not going to decide this because the issue is moot, because New York City has changed its regulation. As I think you know, the city is trying very hard to get the court to dismiss the case is moot because they kept changing their regulations.
Yeah.
Avoid the case. The court said no, but they didn't say, it said, no, we're not going to dismiss the case, but they will consider the mootness argument. So that is a possibility. And of course, I think the city was desperate to have the case mooted because they know they do not have a very strong legal argument, that the regulations are absurd on their face, don't advance public safety, and clearly infringe upon your Second Amendment rights.
Absolutely. And to take things back full circle, Donald Verrilli, the former Solicitor General, who's now representing the plaintiffs in the case against Remington, he actually argued before the Supreme Court back in 2011 that this lower standard should be used, that, that the Second Amendment, in essence, should be treated as a second class right. We've been arguing this for nearly a decade. And you know, I hope, I don't know that the court is going to listen to me, but I hope that they do not throw this case out because of mootness. I know that the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association attorneys, including Paul Clement, another former Solicitor General, have argued that even with the changes that New York City and even New York State have made, that there are still some live issues, and this litigation should not be mooted because there are still some questions before the court. But I guess, again, we'll see what the court does here in a few weeks. Larry Keene, thank you again for coming on the program.
Well, we may not know what they will hear the argument, but we won't know what they're going to do until June.
Right.
Yeah. But, yeah. And people always try to read the tea leaves in oral arguments, which is always dangerous.
Absolutely. Yeah, you got to be really careful when you start trying to predict what the Supreme Court's going to do. That might be one of the last, leak-proof institutions in our nation's capital. But,
it's true.
Larry, as always, sir, thank you so much for your time. Yes, sir.
It's only about 3 months. The pitchers and catchers report, so.
All right. We're going to, you know what? We've talked about it for years, but I think 2020 might have to be the year that we get together for a Yankees Red Sox summit.
That'd be great.
All right. We'll try to make that happen. Larry Keene with the National Shooting Sports Foundation. Thank you, sir. All right. Before we get to our armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivism report, there is a story that I want to highlight out of Colorado. So it is sweeps period around the country. If you're watching your local TV newscast, you notice that they're doing a lot of special programming, a lot of in-depth investigations, things of that nature. We've talked about this before. This is the advertising period where they set the advertising rates. And so you get a lot of these special programming. Nine News in Denver has done a big investigation on Colorado's magazine ban. Back in 2013, Colorado's governor at the time, John Hickenlooper, signed several gun control bills into law, including a quote-unquote universal background check bill, which has done nothing to increase background checks, nor has it done anything to reduce violent crime, since crime is up in Colorado since 2013. They also passed a ban on magazines over 15 rounds. So Nine News went to investigate and found that there's massive noncompliance with this law. There's also language in the legislation that allows for parts kits to be sold legally. And the state representative who was the original author of this mag ban is very upset by the fact that her language actually allows for magazine part kits to be sold, even 20, 30, 60 round magazine part kits. And it's legal to get those part kits. It's also incredibly difficult to enforce this gun control law. Since 2013, when the law was put into effect, Nine News in Denver found that there have been 128 cases where a charge has been brought against somebody for having a magazine in violation of Colorado state law. The vast majority of those cases, however, the magazine charge was an additional charge that was tacked on, and there were more serious underlying offenses involved. And by the way, out of those 128 cases, six individuals have actually been sentenced to any jail time whatsoever. Yeah, that's it. Meanwhile, you do have some gun stores in Colorado that are just outright selling magazines over 15 rounds. And one of the gun store's employees was under the impression that, our sheriff's just not going to enforce this law. That's a pretty risky assumption. Weld County Sheriff Steve Reams, where this gun store is located, said, look, I've said I'm not going to enforce red flag laws. He said, but I haven't said anything about the magazine ban. He did say it's not going to be a primary focus of any investigation. Nobody's going out there and, you know, we heard that Bob has a 30-round magazine. Well, let's go stake out his house. Like, that's not happening. As a matter of fact, the sheriff still says that the magazine ban is worthless and should be scrapped, but he's not ruling out that, he might bring a charge against somebody if it's appropriate, but he's not going to go out there looking for folks with these 20-round or 30-round magazines. Anyway, the whole story is worth checking out. I've got it written up at Bearing Arms, but you can also check out 9 News' report as well. And we'll keep paying attention because it looks like we might see some additional gun control legislation dealing with this issue in Colorado coming up next year. All right, let's get to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivism report. We'll start there. Alabama, Anaya Blanchard was abducted in Auburn, Alabama, outside of a convenience store a few nights ago. And the suspect who has been arrested and charged in her disappearance, as it turns out, has quite the lengthy criminal history. Ibrahim Yazid was arrested in Florida on first-degree kidnapping charges in connection with the disappearance. Surveillance footage allegedly shows Yazid was there at the convenience store at the time of Anaya Blanchard. Police believe that Yazid may not have been acting alone. But now we've learned that Yazid was out on bail on some very serious criminal charges, attempted murder charges, as a matter of fact, despite the fact that he has a lengthy criminal history, which includes previous arrests for kidnapping and robbery. And despite that previous criminal history, despite those serious charges, he was allowed out on bail for attempted murder, now accused again of kidnapping for at least the second time in his life. And police are very concerned about the whereabouts of this young woman who was abducted, Anaya Blanchard, and there is not much hope that she is alive, unfortunately. So we may be looking at homicide charges against Ibrahim Yazid and any other potential suspects as well. But he should have been behind bars, not out on the streets. He is today's recidivist report. Now, our armed citizen story from Reno, Nevada, where a Reno burglar arrested in Lassen County, California. Yeah. Sheriff's deputies say he broke into a home, stole the homeowner's gun before he was caught and held at gunpoint by the homeowner and his neighbor. It was November 11th, around 4:30 in the afternoon. Police got a call from the neighbor stating that the homeowner was in his garage and had the suspect in custody. So police arrived. And the neighbor also said, by the way, that this individual, Matthew Isaac Cisternos, was armed with the homeowner's gun that he had found there in garage. Another neighbor armed himself, according to Channel 12 News in California, helped the homeowner keep the suspect detained until deputies arrived. During his search, they found a revolver on the suspect. The homeowner confirmed that it was his. They also learned that the truck driven by Cisternos had been reported stolen in Reno, Nevada earlier that day. Officials say Cisternos went inside the homeowner's garage, found several guns, put them into a boat that was also in the garage, and then tried to steal the boat. Yeah, right now he's facing several felony charges. He's booked into the Lassen County, California jail on $30,000 bail. But he's facing a burglary, grand theft of a firearm, as well as vehicle theft charges. The homeowner and the neighbor, they're okay. That's the good news. Hopefully, given the fact this is California, though, I don't know that Mr. Cisternos, frankly, he's going to be spending much time behind bars, even if he is convicted for these alleged crimes. Now, our good deed of the day. I don't know what the temperature is like where you live, but it is flipping cold in Farmville, Virginia this week. It was a balmy 17 degrees when I woke up this morning. We did not get any snow in Farmville as this, Arctic cold front moved through. I saw my friend Adam Trahan on Twitter dancing around the snow in Nashville, Tennessee the other night. So some portions of the country did get quite a bit of snow with this weather system. That'd be the case in Floyd County, Kentucky. And yes, I realize this is the second day in a row that we've had a good deed involving a sunken car. Weird how it works out that way, but Floyd County, Kentucky, Woman being called a hero after jumping into an icy pond to save a driver. Police had actually gotten the call, or Floyd County Sheriff's Office said they got a call about 2 p.m. Tuesday about a car in a pond with a gentleman who was unconscious in the driver's seat. Now, by the time police arrived, they found a Good Samaritan in the water trying to help this guy out. A woman in her 60s, she had been driving by when she saw the car and then jumped into that water. Officer Alex Bilbrey said the lady was probably in the water for at least 5 minutes. I'm not sure how much longer the driver was in the water, probably 4 to 5 minutes. So she was pretty quick to react. When she saw it, she jumped out. She got into the water. State police helped the sheriff's office pull the car out of the water. Don't know the condition of the driver, but we do believe that woman who came to his aid is going to be okay, even after spending a few minutes there in those freezing temperatures. And again, in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. I don't even know her name, but she is our good deed of the day recipient, and we thank you for your good deed. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Thank you for being a part of the program today. We always love having you around. You can find us at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, townhall.com's podcast page. You can also subscribe to Town Hall Media at YouTube, and that way you never miss a Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Don't forget as well to sign up for your VIP access to Bearing Arms. We get exclusive content. You'll get sneak peeks at some of our columns and reporting. And if you are a VIP Gold member, you'll even get the opportunity to take part in some editor's chats where we will talk one-on-one, or, well, maybe not one-on-one, but we'll talk together about some of the news of the day. Thank you again for supporting Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. We will see you back here tomorrow. Oh, by the way, tonight I'm going to my county supervisors meeting to talk in favor of a Second Amendment sanctuary resolution. Talk about that tomorrow.